Chapter 4, Birth of an Old Fart. At the end of 1985, Sugar Babies went dark for the holidays, and I headed back to college to finish my degree. My goal was to graduate at the end of 1986, and it almost didn't happen. By the middle of the fall semester, I wasn't passing a single subject. I broke up with my girlfriend Susan, lost touch with many friends, and I'd lost a lot of weight. My parents had no idea what was going on. Was I doing too many shows? Was it depression? Women? Was I sick? On drugs? Addicted to porn? None of the above. It was all about helicopters. It had started 6 years before, in the summer of 1980, when I spotted a radio-controlled helicopter. In those days, radio-controlled airplanes were plentiful, and really serious hobbyists spent hundreds of hours and sometimes thousands of dollars building their little crafts. However, technology was just emerging for model rotorcraft. I'd never seen one before, and as the 4-foot-long machine lifted off the parking lot and settled into a 5-foot perfect hover, I was mesmerized. After watching it fly for a few minutes, I marched straight into the hobby store and spent about $1,000 on a kit, engine, radio, and everything else I needed to get started. 2 weeks later, I'd built the thing and gone through multiple sets of blades and parts just trying to learn to hover. A few months later, and I could hover the now $2,000 machine upside down an inch off the pavement. Flash forward 6 years. In the spring of 1986, I was out in an open field not far from the Baylor campus flying one of my model helicopters. A guy who was obviously not a Baylor student and who looked to be about my age stopped to watch the aerobatics. He was wearing a baseball cap that looked like it had been used to clean up the counter at Dairy Queen. His t-shirt and jeans were smeared with God knows what, and he drove an old blue Datsun pickup that was about as clean as his hat. He stood at a respectable distance until I landed and then walked over for a chat. People were always stopping to watch the flying and ask questions, so I tried to be as polite as possible, but to also give off the air of not wanting to be bothered. The guy's name was Keith Jones. Turned out he'd been flying for a couple of months too. We chatted a little and soon traded phone numbers and met a couple of times to fly together. Keith was a plumber and the son of a plumber. His parents were divorced, and he lived on a couple of acres of land in a small farmhouse with his mom, sister, and sometimes girlfriend. We couldn't have been from more different backgrounds, but we soon became flying buddies and best friends. One day, when riding with him in the Datsun down a 2-lane highway to lunch, some guy started tailgating Keith a little too aggressively. It went on that way for a mile or so, and Keith got a little miffed. I'd always wondered why he had a big styrofoam cup filled with BBs on the floorboard, but I'd never asked what they were for. I was about to find out. "That guy's an asshole," Keith said. "Yep," I replied. "Get the BBs," he said. "For what?" "See down there?" he pointed. The rubber boot around the gear shift of the Datsun was gone, and you could see straight down through the floorboard to the pavement rushing past. "Yeah," I answered. "Pour that cup of BBs down the hole, slow at first, and then faster and faster. We'll see how long it takes the turd to back off." This was the funniest thing I'd heard in a long time. Keith continued driving, and I started pouring the steel shot down the hole. Those balls of metal hit the highway at 70 miles per hour in a constant stream, and in no time were peppering the other guy's truck. He must have had no idea what was hitting his car or his windshield. The guy started to weave, then slow down, then swerve, then finally veered off into the ditch while we sped away, almost killing ourselves. We were laughing so hard.
"I love the BB story. Next time, try biological weapons. They work even better."
"Ahmed,
just my 2 cents."
One day, Keith came to my apartment and told me that he'd found something really cool during a visit to the junkyard the day before. He told me there was an old but real, full-sized, 2-seat helicopter that had been made from a kit, and it was sitting on a trailer. "A kit?" I asked. "For a real helicopter? One you can sit in? Let's go!" That was the first time I saw a very early version of a rotorway helicopter. Keith recognized it first from their ads in Popular Mechanics. Sure enough, we bought a copy, and there was a tiny little ad in the back. "Psst! Fly your own home-built helicopter." This couldn't have been any cooler.
"Actually, it could have been cooler."
"How?"
"It could have said, 'Fly a helicopter built by a professional helicopter builder and not you.' You're a complete idiot."
That afternoon, I ordered an information packet. A week later, I found myself on a Southwest Airlines flight heading from Austin to Phoenix for a factory tour and demo ride. 2 weeks after that, I got up the nerve to wire most of the money I'd saved from Sugar Babies to Rotorway. One of my goals had always been to own and fly a real helicopter, and now here I was, taking the plunge. Sure, I had to build the helicopter first, but their builder support and in-house flight training school was unparalleled. A few weeks later, 14 big crates showed up at Keith's house, and we loaded them into his barn. Even the engine was in one of the boxes. I honestly had no idea if I could do this. There was welding and fiberglassing and assembling and construction and wiring and testing and tuning. At certain points, the FAA had to come and inspect my work. Then I had to go for pilot training. It was a little stressful, but I kept telling myself, this is just like the little ones, only bigger. I spent the next 7 months building the helicopter. My undivided attention was in that barn and with construction manuals and not in my school textbooks. That's when the GPA went south and my girlfriend moved north. But I built the aircraft, passed Rotaway's flight school, and started flying all over Central Texas in my own home-built helicopter.
Could you be any more antisocial playing with dolls and flying in a helicopter?
I got in the Mile High Club in a helicopter.
Bubba Jay.
Okay, it was a 10-cent ride in front of the grocery store, but it still counts.
The only thing I didn't ignore during all this was my act. I was doing as many shows as I could book, and I was still planning on moving to LA to pursue my goals. Getting on The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson was still my top priority, but I now simply wasn't in as much of a hurry as I had been. After a few visits to Los Angeles and doing a few shows at a couple of the clubs, I realized that I wasn't quite ready to take on that town. I wasn't getting as many laughs or as big a laughs as the LA comics were in their hometown. This was an environment that was still very unfamiliar and somewhat frightening to me. Also, and just as important, I knew I was still missing that edge. What that edge was, I didn't know exactly. I just knew it wasn't there. I knew that experience plus a little maturity as a performer would help. So this helicopter business was a superb way to bide my time, but to also work on the funny. When I finally graduated in the fall of 1986, as my name was called and I crossed the stage to receive my degree, a familiar voice rose from the crowd and bellowed, "Yay!" A public outburst like that from my father was unheard of up until that moment. But as he later told me, "When you graduated, I felt like I got a raise." After 6 long years, he was finally done paying for college. I finally had my Bachelor of Arts degree, but my parents had no illusions that I was ever going to try and find a normal job. There was only once in my life that I can remember either of them ever betraying even the slightest hint of doubt about my career choice. On one of my visits home from college, Mom and Pop and I were sitting at lunch at Luby's Cafeteria, where we ate almost every single Sunday after church. My dad said to me, "You know, a lot of our friends talk about their kids and what they'll be doing soon. Fred Miller says his son John is going to be a neurophysicist. The Jacobs say Susie is going to be a criminal lawyer. We have to say, well, Jeff is still doing his puppet show." To this day, I'm still not quite sure if Pop was being funny or if he was trying to make a point. Even though the career choice might have seemed iffy at best, I always had gigs on the books, I was always making money, and each step was a new adventure for them as well as me. Most important, I never questioned whether I would succeed. You could say I simply had confidence, but I didn't see it that way because I just never considered failure. There were no other choices because I left myself no other options. I didn't have a backup plan. I guess there's a little irony in the fact that one of my favorite inspirational lines in a movie was spoken by a puppet. From The Empire Strikes Back, when Yoda was training Luke.
"Try not. Do or do not. There is no try."
Good for you. You just quoted a midget in a rubber suit.
Wait a minute.
What a beautiful message.
I think so.
Quit trying. Yeah, that's a nice message.
After graduating, I stayed in Waco for almost 2 more years. I was having too much fun piloting the chopper. It wasn't unusual for me to simply take off from Little MacGregor Airport and fly in any given direction with no destination in mind, simply seeing what I could find. I had a gas can strapped in the seat beside me, and if I was running low, I'd just land next to a gas station in the middle of nowhere, fill up, and be on my way. All I had was a paper map, a compass, and a lot of blue Texas skies. Even though deep down I knew I wasn't ready for Los Angeles, at times it was easy to kid myself into thinking I was funnier than I was because I was playing for such easy and forgiving audiences at Baylor and at church shows or for small civic and corporate gatherings. I had a safe little act that made people laugh at those small performances and at the ventriloquist conventions. Some of those crowds were a little tough, but none of them were the big time. I'd only been out of my league on a few occasions during short visits to LA and New York, and even those were middle or guest spots where no one had purchased a ticket to see just me. There was really no pressure in shows like that. Being the middle act for a headliner is like an easy layup. No one expects you to be great. You just have to make the shot or get out of the game. But after the year of doing well in Sugar Babies, I thought I finally might have what it took to be on The Tonight Show. On one of my excursions to LA in the spring of 1986, Mike Lacy got me an audition for one of The Tonight Show's talent bookers, Jim McCauley. Comics either loved or hated Jim, and of course it was all based on if you got on the show or not. If he booked you, you loved him. If he didn't, well, guys use words to describe him like stupid and asshole. Lacy was convinced that I was right for The Tonight Show and convinced Jim to watch my act. McCauley was known to hit 2 and 3 clubs a night, hunting for fresh talent, and in those days, Carson was the only game on late-night TV for comics. There were other talk shows that utilized stand-ups, but you really hadn't made it until you had done Johnny's show and done well. That night at Comedy Magic, I used Ollie and did my very best, most spectacular 6 minutes, which included Jose Jalapeno and the worm in the bottle and drinking while Ollie talked. I'd done the routine a million times and I thought I did really well. I was disappointed to find out after the show that McCauley left without a word. He was also there that night to watch Roseanne Barr, who was preparing for her third stand-up spot on Carson. This was very early in her skyrocketing ascension, much before her sitcom, and those first few times she destroyed on Carson with her stand-up. I've heard all the horror stories about Roseanne in later years, but that wasn't the woman I met that night. She couldn't have been more kind or encouraging. "Don't worry about it," she said. "He's a good guy and you did great. I'm sure he'll call you. He probably just had something he had to get to." I flew back to Texas the next day and expected a call from Jim any minute. Good news or bad, I just wanted to talk to him and hear what he thought. I called his secretary that morning and left every number possible. I told my parents that if he called their house, to please leave a message on my machine in Waco. Every hour I would call my answering machine no matter where I was to see if Jim had left a message. Even during the 100-mile drive from Dallas to Waco, I stopped at a couple of gas stations just to call my apartment and check. For 2 days, nothing. Finally, at the end of the second day, and after I had left multiple messages, his secretary must have talked him into picking up the phone, probably out of sheer frustration. "You're pretty persistent," he stated. "Yes, sir," I answered. I couldn't stand it any longer. "What did you think?" I asked. This was 6 years into the 10 that I'd given myself to make it to Carson, and the silence on the other end of the line was about to kill me. The clock ticked. I don't think there was a pause because he was annoyed. Maybe it wasn't even a real pause. It just felt like forever to me. "Well, honestly, you're just not ready," Jim said. Something inside me dropped and I suddenly felt incredibly stupid. How could I have ever thought this was possible? Seriously, what were the odds? I was a ventriloquist. Deep down, his answer hadn't really surprised me, but I had dreamed and imagined and hoped and prepared for so long for this moment. Was I close? What's not right? I had to ask. There was silence on the line again. I could hear the hum in the wires, then some shuffling of papers, maybe even a pen tapping. "You're not ready," he said. "Okay, but what do you mean exactly? What can I do to be ready?" I pushed. I didn't want to let him go until I had some idea of what I needed to be doing to get on the show. Was there really a possibility? Jim McCauley sat for a few more seconds, then he finally said, "Your skills are great and the bits are good, but it's just not funny enough. Johnny likes funny. You need good jokes. So when you've made it funnier, I'll come see you again." "Really?" I asked. "Of course," he replied. All I wanted was hope, and he'd just given that back to me. McCauley was no asshole. He'd turned down hundreds of other comics many times, but most of the time he was talking to agents and managers and not some green, fresh out of college kid. I think he heard the drive and hope in my voice, and he knew how much I wanted to succeed. I hung up the phone dejected and depressed, but still with something to work toward. I had a lot of confidence from all those years of performing, but it didn't mean anything if I wasn't funny enough for Johnny Carson himself. How long would it be until I was ready to audition again? The most important thing I realized that day was that if this were to happen, it wasn't going to be nearly as easy as I thought. Someone once told me that they didn't think a comic could write any meaningful material until at least their late 20s because a person hasn't lived long enough and been through enough crap to have a deep enough well to draw from. I understood and believed that. It wasn't simply fear holding me back from moving to Los Angeles. I'd already had practical experience with LA audiences, and I knew what I was in for. But I was only 24, and as I said before, I knew my act still didn't have the kind of edge it required. Also, I still needed that signature character that could show audiences that Vent really could be mainstream again. I wanted characters that were different and memorable, comedy that was cutting edge, and an act that was as popular as any stand-up comic of modern day. But I hadn't figured out anything beyond Archie or Ollie. Jose Jalapeno was good, but he wasn't a leading man. I continued to bide my time. I kept flying my helicopter. In the spring of 1987, I was hired to fill the variety spot in the much-scaled-down Atlantic City version of Sugar Babies, starring Carol Lawrence and Rip Taylor. Carol had originated the role of Maria in West Side Story some 30 years earlier. Rip, aka the Prince of Pandemonium, was known for a wild stand-up act that featured throwing confetti into the air and had been a big hit on the Brady Bunch Hour and the Gong Show. No, this was certainly not the original version of Sugar Babies, but it was experience and a gig most guys in my position would kill for, so off to New Jersey I sped. A few days into the gig, and I met a cocktail waitress named Donna. She looked as Irish as could be with red hair, fair skin, and a smile that melted me. After going out with her a few weeks, I learned about New Jersey dating etiquette. One night when my 300ZX sat unguarded in the casino parking garage, Donna's ex-boyfriend proceeded to knock in the car's windshield with a baseball bat. We knew it was him because he bragged about it to her the next day. Being the tough guy that I was at the time, I retaliated as best I knew how. I didn't do anything. I wanted to think about it for a while, but apparently my inaction was more effective than any revenge I could plan. Donna told me later that the goofball was constantly terrified of what I was planning for him, and the more time that went by, the jumpier and more scared he got. We laughed about that for weeks.
Did her ex-boyfriend want to play baseball with you?
I don't think so.
Maybe a baseball bat is what they go hunting with in New Jersey.
Back in Waco for a weekend break, I headed to my helicopter hangar. I hadn't flown in many weeks. I needed to get back in the air. Remember that at that time, I was an incredibly inexperienced student pilot, having logged only 40 hours in the air. Inexperience combined with overconfidence is a dangerous thing in aviation. Welcome to my nightmare. That day, I flew a few miles away from my hangar to practice autorotations. This was a good thing to master because you never know if and when an engine just might quit. Odds are good against this happening, but a good pilot needs to have the instincts for what to do if and when it happens. During the autos, I was adding in 180 and 360 degree turns during descent. You spiral down pretty quickly in those turns, and it's darned exciting because in a real tight one, the ship is literally over on its side, heading down fast. On about my sixth one, I got turned around with my ground references and ended up at the end of the auto rotation, a few feet above the ground, going with the wind. This was a big no-no in a helicopter this small with such light blades. I thought the wind was on my nose when in fact it was right on my tail at 15 miles per hour or faster. That's bad for anyone, much less a novice pilot. Worse, I didn't recognize I was in trouble until it was way too late. When I pulled the nose up and asked the ship to slow down on ground speed, it didn't, and I ran out of rotor speed. I tried to slide the helicopter in and cushion the touchdown, but there was no lift or speed left in the blades, and I was over a plowed cornfield. I hit once on the skids, then twice, and now heading sideways at a pretty good clip, the right skid hit a furrow, folded under, and we hit and rolled at about 20 miles per hour. The world tumbled, the windshield broke, dirt and debris filled the cabin, and all I could do was hang on to the controls and wait for silence. The engine screamed, the blades plowed the dirt, a few parts flew, and then it was over. The beautiful ship ended up on her side, and I was hanging from my harness. The helicopter was a mess, but thanks to the good Lord, dumb luck, and a beautifully designed 4130 chrome alloy steel frame and roll cage, I was still alive. I trudged the 3 miles back to the hangar over fields, across creeks, and through a few brambles. I suffered only a mild bump on my head and badly bruised ego. When I got back to the hangar, I called Keith. He came out, and we got my trailer and headed for the field where my total wreck of a chopper was on its side, bleeding out fluids. It took us a couple of hours to haul the hulking mess onto the trailer and start heading back for Keith's barn. We were pulling a crashed helicopter lying on its side. I had never been more depressed. Before pulling out onto the highway with Mangled Bird in tow, Keith scribbled out a sign on a piece of cardboard and hung it on the back of the trailer. Shit happens. This was the first time I'd ever heard the expression. It's not exactly Socrates, Thoreau, or the Bible, but since then, saying those two simple words has comforted me a lot when I had no other answer.
Sorry, Mrs. Dunham.
What are you doing?
I'm apologizing to your mother who's listening to this for your use of the S word.
It's part of the story.
Well, I think we all could have gotten the point if you had said, stuff happens.
I guess you're right.
Dumb shit.
Not long after that, Sugar Babies closed for good, and I went back to Waco, intent on doing nothing but aircraft repair. I was a firm believer in getting back on the proverbial horse, so I couldn't wait to get flying again and do a successful auto rotation. Keith felt the same way, but with a slightly different twist. You'd better fly it back to the crash site and do a bunch of autos to that same spot over and over. The odds of the same helicopter crashing in the exact place two times in a row are pretty low, so you'll be safe. That sounded like genius logic to me. 3 months later, I did just that. I did an auto to the ground and landed right on the spot where I'd crashed. I was wearing Ray-Ban aviator sunglasses the day I crashed, and now I took them out of their case. I hadn't worn them since. They were bent pretty badly when I banged my head, and I purposefully left them that way. They also still had the dirt on them from where they landed on the ground when they flew off my head. I straightened them out, wiped off the dirt, put them back on, then took off again and had a good day of flying. Did I learn anything from the experience? Yeah, two things. Don't auto with the wind, and shit happens. In the Harris Sugar Babies, I had tried replacing Ollie with a horse as a main character. Yes, a horse. Verna made him, and he was a Clydesdale named Clyde. I shudder even as I read these words. I still did the little dummy thing and the worm in the bottle. Jose Jalapeno was memorable and amusing, but I knew the whole show still wasn't as funny as it could be, nor were these the characters that were all defining. When I went to the 1987 Ventriloquist Convention that July, I was still searching. That year, graphic artist Bill Nelson showed up with a frowning dummy which looked very similar to Bergen's Frowning Charlie, a figure Bergen had made for the 1947 Disney film Fun and Fancy Free. A couple of years before, Nelson had illustrated a beautiful portrait of Frowning Charlie and sold print reproductions of the work. They were absolutely fantastic, and I kick myself now for not having purchased one of the posters. But now, Nelson and figure maker Chuck Jackson had created their own version of a frowning figure and had named him Mr. Horowitz. I thought he looked great, but a frowning dummy? I remember overhearing people in the dealer's room at the convention talking in hushed sentences like, "What in the world would you do with that? You can't do comedy with it. He'll never sell." I took those comments as a challenge, wondering what I could do with them. During conventions, dealers had the opportunity to get in front of the crowd and show or demonstrate their wares. Bill never wanted to perform. I thought to myself, if I'm actually any good at this, I should be able to make that frowning Mr. Horowitz work. "Could I demonstrate this one for you?" I asked Bill. "Sure," he said. "I'm not going up there." Within 10 seconds of taking the dummy on stage, I realized I could easily connect with this type of character. I started to ad lib. "What do you do for a living?" I asked Mr. Horowitz.
"I'm an inventor."
"What have you invented?"
"You know how when you go in the kitchen and you close one cabinet and the other opens up?"
he asked. "Yeah," I said.
"I did that."
After a few more jokes and some big laughs, I walked off stage wondering if that had been a fluke. My friend Dale Brown told me I should buy the little guy, and Bill quoted me a price that was above anything I could spend at the time. Remember, I had spent most of my money on the helicopter, crashed it, and then spent almost half of that amount rebuilding the thing. I barely had enough in savings to get back and forth to the convention that year. "Bill, I really don't have that kind of money right now," I said. "Could you sell it for a little less? I'll make really good use of him." He wouldn't bargain. I've since heard many versions of what happened that day. Some say Bill offered to sell the rights to the character to me and that I refused, but none of that is true. Back then, I wouldn't have even known what selling the rights meant. I returned to Waco empty-handed, but I didn't forget about the laughs I got that day with the frowning dummy. After pondering for a while, I decided I could create my own version for about $50 in materials. I liked what Bill and Chuck had done, but I preferred Bergen's version, which had more of a pout to the lips and a more forced-looking frown. I was also thinking that an old man would be more interesting. I took part of the inspiration for the character from Keith Jones's father, whose name was Walter, and who happened to be a cantankerous old fart. He wasn't a jerk, but more of a curmudgeon. You could tell that beneath that crusty surface was a guy with a sense of humor. He would grumble a lot, but every so often you'd catch a gleam in his eye after he'd said something that was ornery. As I was contemplating basing my new character on Walter Jones, I then saw Bette Davis on Carson. This was a woman who had been everywhere and done everything. Carson asked her questions, and she just spouted off her opinions on whatever she wanted to talk about. She didn't care if what she said was politically incorrect or offensive or outlandish. She didn't care what anybody thought, and it was refreshing as hell. Carson laughed and spun around in his chair. Cool. Walter Jones, Bette Davis, a frowning old man dummy. I knew I was sitting on something that could be pretty funny, but I didn't think an audience would like the negativity for more than 5 minutes. Boy, was I wrong.
Boy, were you wrong.
I know.
Turns out they couldn't take you for more than 5 minutes.
That's not true.
Hey, shit happens.
I sat down at my workbench in my apartment late one night. Fueled by Dr. Pepper, the same stuff that kept me going when building my helicopter, and with the television broadcasting Carson, then Letterman, I used a dinner knife and then went to work on a big mound of plasticine clay that I'd purchased at an art store that day. The only other tool I used was a small broken mirror that I'd picked up next to the apartment complex dumpster. After making the basic shape of the head, I then looked in the mirror with a frowning scowl and copied the lines of my face into the clay. About 4 hours later, the Star Spangled Banner came on TV, the station went off the air, and snow filled the screen. I looked at the clay. I'd never taken a sculpting class in my life, nor had I read any books on the subject, but what I saw staring back at me was a face that made me laugh. If I made that scowl, it was me, just a few decades older and with a lot less hair. Little did I know what that face was about to do for my career, and how many people he would make laugh throughout the next few decades. The next day, I made a two-piece plaster of Paris mold. I cast the head in plastic wood dough, making front and back head shell pieces. I let the head harden for a couple of days and then installed a moving mouth and raising eyebrows. A head stick and controls were next. For the eyes, I found a local taxidermist and picked out some blue glass spheres and then glued them inside the head, just barely visible through his squinted expression. I painted him a healthy flesh color, made a body with scrap plywood and pine, shaped the chest with baling wire, and quickly molded and cast plastic wood hands as well. Arms and legs were stuffed athletic knee socks, and the feet were plywood. I went to Kmart for kids' clothes, trying to find things that looked as much like an old man's as possible. On a visit to Dallas a few days later, Dad let me have his thin red clip-on bow tie that he'd saved since high school years. Done, and in only 2 weeks from start to finish.
Lazy ass.
What?
You were in such a rush to finish me, you forgot my hair.
I named the dummy Walter after Keith's dad, as well as after another Walter who had a welding shop not far down the street from my apartment complex. The two Walts knew each other, and both those guys were cut from the same cloth. It was a delight to see those two old grumps carry on a conversation. What inspiration.
Shut the hell up, and who the hell cares,
were expressions that just spilled out of my Walter's mouth. Those words became his catchphrases and breaths of life. Next, I gave Walter a backstory. At the time, I made him a Korean War veteran, and 25 years later, he's morphed into a Vietnam vet. He is also a retired welder, has been married forever, and is chronically pissed off at his wife. Well, at least, he says he is. He's just a curmudgeon and actually loves his wife unendingly. He just wants to kill her half the time, too. I don't remember the first time I took him on stage. All I know is that he was a huge hit. What I mistakenly thought would be an extra few minutes in the show quickly became a monster success. Comedy works and characters succeed when an audience can identify with what's being said and who's saying it. Well, everyone knows someone like Walter. They're either married to him, or they work for him, or they're related to him. Whatever it is, we all know that guy. Walter and Jose were now numbers 1 and 2 of a soon-to-be threesome that would define and change my act and my life for good. They would help me accomplish goals and attain heights I had dreamed of and aspired to even as a young boy, but they would also be part of a bigger team in the distant future that would take me places I never dreamed I would perform, or where I ever thought I could. As big a hit as Walter was, I didn't really think of him as ever being the main character. I thought of him as a great addition, and that I hadn't found the perfect main sidekick yet. So, the search continued.
Although the search continued for a main sidekick, I knew deep down in my heart that Walter was truly the one.
Excuse me, what are you doing?
I was telling the rest of the story for you.
I'm doing the telling.
Damn it.
It was now the spring of 1988, and all was well. I was still living single in my Waco apartment, flying my newly rebuilt helicopter as much as possible, and hanging out with friends in the newsroom at KWTX. Jordan Cox, Kelly Grinnell, David Franks, Barry Ray, Robin Johnson, Dave Evans, Skeeter Williams, Archie Woodard. These were all the folks whose friendships I cherished. I was the only one without a real job, but a lot of us had been at Baylor together and had remained friends, so they tolerated me hanging around. Every once in a while, they would use the characters in me on air in the Baylor homecoming parades or during the local segments of the Jerry Lewis telethons or for pretty horrible local television commercials. My favorites were for the Central Texas Wild Animal Park. I would take a character or two out to the preserve, and we would set up the camera with me standing next to or holding one of the live animals. Then I would try and ad-lib a 30 or 60-second spot, getting in as much information as possible before either I or the puppet were pecked, poked, strangled, or chewed to death by the particular wild beast. Snooky, the young chimp, wins for using up the most tape for retakes. I used the gray monkey one day, and Snooky had no idea what to think. Every time my ape would start to talk, Snooky would jump on my lap and either try to choke the ape, rip his head off, or bite his neck. And of course, the ape's neck and head were my arm and hand. The outtakes are something to behold. As time went by, and as I experimented with more and more characters, including Walter and Jose, I realized that I really needed my main character to have a powerful personality without extreme personality traits that would pigeonhole him. In other words, he needed to be broad. Think Mickey Mouse, Kermit the Frog, Bart Simpson, Bugs Bunny, or even Harry Potter. They aren't extreme caricatures, such as Barney Grumble on The Simpsons, Cruella de Vil, or Yosemite Sam.
When do we get to me?
Later.
I am bored. Can I get this book on Laserdisc?
I also knew that I wanted a main character to move. He needed to have energy to jolt the audience into attention. I'd seen the boring Vent Axe, and I wanted to be different. I wanted some pop in my show, and it had to come from the right character and the right puppet. I spent a lot of time alone in my hangar, tightening belts, checking torques, getting greasy, and putting duct tape on bloody cuts when I ran out of Band-Aids. All that time allowed my mind to wander to the problem of a main character. I will never forget, after a long day at the hangar, standing in the middle of my apartment, and the image of Peanut just popping into my head. It all came together and made so much sense. Finally. I called Verna, who had made a couple of soft figures for me already, and started describing him to her in great detail. I told her, I don't want him to be human, but at least humanoid. Not a monkey or an ape. He needs to be a unique creature unlike anything else, but certainly a mammal because mammals are warm and fuzzy. He needs to have appeal and be something that people would want to hug. I knew that if this was going to be my main guy, I wanted commercial potential. One of my goals, even as far back as high school, was to have toy versions of my characters on the shelves of stores one day. And if one of these guys could be plush and huggable, well, all the better. I want skinny long arms and big hands so he can gesture easily. I don't want him to sit, so his legs need to be short enough so he can stand next to me, but not be too tall. I think he should have tan fur all over him, but his arms, legs, hands, and feet need more of a skin. His head should be that way too, and his belly. For the color of skin, almost nothing made sense. If the skin were red, he'd look like a devil. Green, he'd look like an alien. Blue would be too Smurf-like. Yellow is too light for bright lights. Brown or gray, he'd look like a monkey. So, purple. Not dark, but more of a lavender. I don't know of any popular characters who are purple. This was pre-Barney the Dinosaur. Give him a big tuft of green hair on top, green eyes, big lips, and make his nose removable. What? Verna said. Purple skin didn't faze her, but a removable nose apparently got her attention. I don't know, I said. I just want to make sure he doesn't look too human, so maybe a nose I can take on or off. Can you put Velcro on the back of it? Well, yes, she replied. After a few more conversations describing and showing what I wanted, plus sending some drawings back and forth with notes here and there, a few weeks later, Peanut showed up. He was absolutely perfect. I'd also asked to give him one shoe. This would guarantee at least one good laugh with him in every show. My longtime friend and fellow vent David Erskine gave me the joke, and it dates back to vaudeville from what I understand. I think it was the first joke Peanut ever told. Peanut, you lost a shoe.
No, man, I found one.
And then he would laugh hilariously at himself. One of the moves that I used very early on with Peanut was with his left hand squishing over his head through his hair and him yelling, "Meow!" I used it to make fun of myself or someone in the front row for not understanding a joke. He did it his first performance ever, and he still does it today. It became a catch thing for him, just like Jose's,
"Honestique. When I joined the act, everyone loved me."
"I did not, senor."
"Everyone who didn't have a pole coming out of their butt."
Once I started working with him, all his mannerisms and his personality evolved very quickly. I named him Peanut because that was easy to remember, and the name simply fit the character. It seems so simple now. As for his voice, once again, it fits him. I tried to give him a backstory that would give him an Earth origin, but something exotic that would be difficult to deny and easy to imagine. So it turns out he was from a race of people just like him who lived on the Micronesian islands near Guam. Another of Peanut's first jokes was corny as hell, but never failed to get a huge laugh. "I understand you have some brothers."
"Yep. Eeny, meeny, miny, and Fred."
"Fred, what happened to Mo?"
"Mo? Oh, my mama don't want no Mo."
And once again, he would laugh his maniacal crazy laugh. Peanut debuted in Northern California at a firefighter's fundraising event that was an outdoor show for the public. It was an all-ages family crowd, and the first show out, Peanut killed. On that same weekend, we headed back down to Los Angeles and did a guest spot at the Comedy and Magic Club in Hermosa Beach. Once again, gold. From that weekend forward, he was a hit in front of every imaginable crowd, blue-collar and white-collar, young and old, bikers and businessmen. The material was wacky, and he was loud, obnoxious, and just plain crazy. He would make fun of me incessantly, telling me I was a loser for never having any dates, or he would pick on any poor soul in the front row, laughing at them and all his own jokes to boot. Next, I hit gold when I matched Jose and Peanut. Peanut was the perfect character to make fun of the slowpoke Jose, but Jose in turn would always one-up Peanut. Eventually, I even got one of those cassette courses to teach myself some Spanish so the two could converse while leaving the bewildered me out of it all. Add to this mix Walter, who was almost the exact opposite style of comedy. Walter became my secret weapon when it came to winning over tired and soured audiences at corporate gatherings. Walter and Peanut were perfect foils back then. Peanut almost always ended up being hero of the night when the audience was made up of fans, but any business crowd preferred Walter. Most of the businessmen at the end of a long evening of drinks, dinner, awards, and speeches certainly didn't want to have to sit through another painful 45 minutes from a ventriloquist dummy. Well, Walter didn't want to be there either and was pissed he had to be there with them. Bringing Walter out and meeting these guys at their own level was an easy way to win them over. Given the many soft and lovable characters Jim Henson had created, I was surprised that even the late Muppets creator liked Walter better than Peanut. At the 10th anniversary celebration for the Center for Puppetry Arts in Atlanta, Henson told me, "I just love Walter." He asked to see Walter up close and he complimented me on how much character I'd put into him. That was a huge moment for me. Later that evening between shows, I found myself alone backstage and there lay Kermit the Frog dead and on a table like he'd been stepped on by Big Bird. I knew it was a major no-no, but I couldn't help myself. I went over and picked up Kermit and put him on my hand. Cool. It was the summer of 1988, and my career clock began ticking. I was friends with a guy named John Williams, who was an old-time pilot with a hangar next to mine in Waco. He'd shared plenty of wisdom with me over the past couple of years. Once, I came flying back to the hangar with summer storms flashing lightning all around the airport and winds gusting pretty high. I should have landed somewhere else to let the storms pass. After I landed and shut down that day, he came over to me and said,
"Every pilot is given a certain amount of luck with his flying, and you've just used up a good portion of yours."
One day that summer, I was truly soul-searching, and I said to him, "I love just being here and flying, John. I'm making okay money, and I've never had more fun. I just wonder if it's time to move to Los Angeles and really chase after my dreams." John was in his 70s, and he was never happier than when he was flying, so I thought I really had an ally when it came to staying in Waco and enjoying my helicopter. His answer surprised me.
"Are you kidding me? Don't be crazy. Move to Los Angeles. Follow your dream. You can take up flying anywhere, anytime."
Not long after that, my friend Jordan Cox and I had a similar conversation. We were sitting at his apartment and were killing ourselves laughing at some of the wacky jokes and bits I'd come up with for Peanut. Out of the blue and in the middle of the laughs, he just stopped and looked at me and said, "What are you doing here?" "What am I doing where?" "In Waco." "I don't know," I said. "You're in Waco, man. You need to do what you need to do. it's time for you to go. Here was another crossroads moment. I knew Jordan was right. College life was over. The helicopter could go with me. I thought for a minute and said, yeah, I know. Sometimes people who lived there would laugh when I said I loved Waco. But I did. It wasn't the town. It was the friends. Everyone's life would go on. Some of the closest relationships and friendships would remain, but most would be memories. It was time to pack up and head for Hollywood.
Hollywood was beckoning.
Right.
It was time for us to ditch our real friends for a set of phony ones.
A month later, in September of 1988, my friends in Waco threw a going-away party for me. The next day, I drove to Dallas, parked the 300ZX in the back driveway at my mom and dad's house, and hitched my 40-foot-long, loaded-down helicopter trailer to the back of my Nissan Pathfinder. As I pulled out of the driveway the next morning, my mom told me to stop. She ran inside the house. A minute later, she came to my driver's side window and, with tears in her eyes, handed me a little bag of cookies. I cried as I drove away from our house. I was my parents' only child, and I had just left them in the driveway, waving a tearful goodbye. But now I knew it was time to move on and to move forward, to keep pursuing the dreams I'd had since childhood and the Carson goal I'd set 8 years before. I had three strong characters and the funny was growing. I had no more excuses. Here we go.